Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone Podcast. Today, we are taking a closer look at some great chamber works, but before we get into that, let's guess that lick.
Guess that lick or don't miss the prize.
Welcome to Guess That Lick, our weekly quiz show that tests our musical memory. Each of us will bring an isolated excerpt of music, either from a recording or just a piano track recording, and the other co-host will have three listens to guess that lick. For a maximum of 5 points per episode, here's the scoring breakdown. 1 point for the piece, 1 point for the movement, one for the composer, one for the time period, and one for the genre. It's a race to the finish each month to see which co-host has the highest score. Without further ado, let's try and guess that lick. I have prepared one for Alex, and I think it's a fun one.
Well, we'll see. I'm getting kind of nervous about this one, so I'm ready if you are.
All right. All right, that was the first listen.
Okay. So I think I can pin down a couple of these, actually. So the genre, it's obviously a piano work. And the time period is, I guess this would be maybe early 20th century, maybe late Romantic. Because I think it's actually Debussy.
That is all correct, yeah. So
really?
It's a piano solo work. It is by Debussy, and that would put it into that kind of turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century.
Oh gosh, this is gonna be tough. I don't think this is a multi-movement work.
Well, the overall work is, but you don't need to name that. It's actually from a book of preludes by Debussy. That's not what I was exactly looking for. So Just kind of looking for the title here.
Okay, I'm gonna need another listen.
Okay. That was the second listen, and I think we've come up with the title here.
Yeah, I think it's The Engulfed Cathedral.
That is correct.
That's
yeah.
The title. Goodness, that's kind of a deep cut there, but like there was obviously the style was very much pointing towards Debussy, and I figured if you had a live recording, it probably was in that public domain a little bit. To be honest, I'm just not super familiar with a lot of Debussy's piano works. I wish I was more familiar, and hopefully over the next couple months doing this, I can get we can maybe play some more of this music. This would be a good one to feature on an episode, actually.
Yeah, this one would be good. It's definitely shows off his characteristic style, and there's so much to all of the movements of this book of preludes. This book also includes The Girl with the Flaxen Hair.
Okay,
so yeah, there's a lot of...
I didn't realize that they were related.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, it's really interesting how he like lays it out all in this kind of large collection of really tuneful melodies, basically.
Yeah, that's a really, really great lick. Thank you for bringing that one in, Fernando. Now I'm going to listen to some more Debussy this week.
And the hint that I was going to give you if you needed it was that we've actually played this, an orchestral arrangement of this.
Yeah.
Which was kind of funny.
But it wasn't written, it was written in French, the title.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that my brain didn't associate it with that immediately because I knew it was cathedral. But once I knew cathedral, I was like, engulfed cathedral. Got it. Yeah. So
right.
This will be coming in my rotation this week.
That sounds great. All right. So we've got total points here. Alex is going up to 10 points for this month. And then lifetime, he will be at 28.
28. All right. Well, I'm catching up. I'm getting close. So.
Right. And that's 28 to my current 30. And we'll see how next week goes.
Absolutely. Well, we hope that you guys all had fun trying to guess that lick with us. Let's go ahead and move on to today's topic. welcome to today's topic. Today we're taking a little bit of a trip through chamber music history here, and it's a pretty relevant topic considering what is happening in academic music and professional music all around the country and the world right now. Groups are having to resort to smaller ensembles to in order to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. So we both have had a lot of chamber music experience, particularly this semester, and it's been commonplace around the world.
Right, and I think it's a great thing to talk about almost all the time, but definitely now, because it has historically been referred to as the music of friends, because it brings small groups of people together and kind of unites them into a small ensemble that is really intimate, and I really enjoy that. And it's really doable and very possible for all kinds of instruments. As we'll see today, we have a lot of different and diverse ensembles to highlight, and I think that's a really fun thing to do for this podcast and for any show.
Yeah, and for me in particular, I think that chamber music was really formative to my development as a musician. We did a lot of chamber music while I was in high school that kind of forced me to, you know, become an independent musician in that sense, because in chamber music, it's more often than not, in fact, 90% of the time, you're the only person playing your part, right?
Right,
you
yeah.
might be doubled occasionally and maybe in another instrument, but almost never on the same instrument.
Exactly, yeah. And that builds up this accountability and this responsibility of your own part and playing musically by yourself and playing proficiently on your own as well. So there's a lot of aspects of chamber music that require so much. It's very demanding music of the performers in every sense.
Absolutely. You can hide in a symphony, but you can't hide in a string quartet.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of string quartets, let's go ahead and take a listen to our first string quartet here. So with chamber music, kind of a brief history here. Chamber music has really been around as long as music has been around, but officially it really started to be formalized with the string quartet and with composers like Franz Joseph Haydn. And we're going to be listening to one of his string quartets today. Haydn is an Austrian composer considered to be one of the most important of the classical period, and in Austria, along with Mozart and Beethoven, he's had this absolute gargantuan contribution to the realm of symphonies and to the realm of chamber music, with 68 string quartets, pretty unprecedented there. And we're going to be listening to one of his most popular. This is his 53rd string quartet, Opus 64, nicknamed the Lark Quartet. And this is the third movement. Let's take a listen. Thank you.
That was Haydn's Lark Quartet, String Quartet number 53, Opus 64. A really fun one, a really light one, like all of Haydn's music, pretty much. It has a really bird-like quality, obviously. That's where the nickname comes from. It's just a delight to listen to, and I think that it's such a unique sound in the classical period, but also a perfect example of the classical period at the same time. It's a really interesting place, and Haydn is one of the premier composers of the classical period. So.
Oh, I totally agree. I think that Haydn's sound is so distinct, and then with this, I think the Lark moniker here is perfectly apt to describe this, because I mean, if it wasn't there, otherwise it would have been like, yeah, this is a really pleasant piece, but I can just, it almost feels like the roost to me a little bit. That's the kind of the imagery I get here a little bit.
Right, and we have to keep in mind with all of these examples what chamber music means. This music was intended to be played in a small room, a chamber.
Yeah.
And so it was only for these four musicians, a string quartet, to play and entertain just a room of people. And I think that it definitely would do that even today. It would entertain people as it was intended to entertain maybe more noble people, right? Or more upper class. Like, yeah, exactly. And, you know your history.
Yeah. And so this Opus 64 is actually a set of six string quartets. This Lark Quartet is the fifth of these, written in 1790. And the Lark Quartet is the most often performed of all of his 68 string quartets. So we wanted to pick one of these that was really recognizable for people at home. This set of quartets is also nicknamed the Tost Quartets, after Johann Tost, Hungarian violinist who actually was the reason that these works were published. He asked Haydn to write these. And like we said, the Lark moniker, it comes from often the violin melody throughout this piece, particularly famous in the first movement. There is a violin melody, but we like this third movement out of the four of them. We think it was a good way to get this chamber music episode started.
Definitely an elegant entrance into the chamber today.
Well, let's move on to one that we just discovered this week that we're really excited about. This is Franz Schubert. He's an Austrian early Romantic composer, and he's kind of a rarity amongst the composers of the time who were associated with Vienna, as he's actually one of the few that were born there. Usually people come to Vienna from the surrounding areas and the surrounding countries, but he was actually born there, fun fact. He has some really large contributions to orchestral music, as well as chamber music and piano works, and most famously, the German Art Song, of course.
Right, the Lieder.
Yes, the Lieder. So lots to listen to with Schubert. This one is kind of an underrated one that I really was not aware of until just recently. This is Schubert's Octet in F major, and this is the fourth movement of the work. I think that you guys are going to find this one really pleasant and really fun. Let's take a listen.
That was Franz Schubert's Octet in F Major. That was the fourth movement, a theme in variations of sorts. Very elegant, very pleasant, kind of a ongoing theme that'll be throughout this whole episode. And to me, when I heard it the first time, I thought, this is almost Pixar-esque. It has this Pixar quality, kind of similar to the music of Up or Toy Story or something like that, where the instrumentation, I think, lends itself to sounding that way in itself. And then also just the actual music, the melody, the way that it's accompanied, all of it together, it has a way of sounding like what we now know of as like that Pixar sound.
Yeah, and speaking of instrumentation, clarinet, bassoon, horn, two violins, viola, cello, and double bass. What a great selection this is. Schubert knew exactly what he was doing, and I kind of wish that there are more pieces with this combination here, because it gives me that Pixar vibe. Talked about the score from A Marriage Story, the Thomas Newman, I think that is. And man, like, I just really, really enjoy this. And it just shows, I'm like, man, I've been sleeping on Schubert for a little while here. I need to listen to a little bit more Schubert each week, because this just puts me in such a good mood, and I love it so much.
Right, and it's, like we said, it is a really strange group of instruments, but it works so well together. It has a very mellow sound, just to the instrumentation itself.
I wonder what the reasoning was that he didn't include flute, because flute was a very common instrument at the time as well, so I'm wondering why he didn't include flute, but I'm kind of glad he didn't, because I think that would have kind of broken up some of the vibe he was going for here.
Yeah, it really keeps it on the mellow side, just having clarinet kind of be the upper voice with the violin.
Right.
And yeah, it has a really, really unique sound. And of course, we have to think also, these instruments weren't exactly the same as they are now as well. The clarinet had a different timbre, and the bassoon, and the horn, all of the instruments, really.
We don't talk about that enough, like how different the music must have been then, and like how much of it was lost to time. Because, I mean, and that's a whole topic about performance practice, but even besides that, just pedagogically, it's like, how are they performing this? Like, you know, like, they don't have all the resources that we do. It's just like, oh, this is how we make it over the break on clarinet, or like, this is how even the mechanisms on the French horn, like, this is how we navigate between some tricky registers with that register key. So I mean, that's a whole nother topic, but really interesting there. So this work was written in 1824. It's actually the same year as two of his other very popular chamber works, Rosamund and the Death of the Maiden, for string quartet. Those are both very, very popular. And unlike those two works, this is a larger scale, actually six movement work, for, like we said earlier, the clarinet, bassoon, horn, and then string section, violins, viola, cello, and double bass. It was modeled after Beethoven's septet, opus 20, and it retains a similar structure, but is quite unique, I would say. Definitely very definitively Schubert, just like the Haydn was very definitively Haydn. The fourth movement that we're playing today is actually a theme in variations. Fernando, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so the first thing you hear is the theme being stated. That's just the main melody and the initial presentation of it. And then I think it's pretty clear how he varies it, how he varies the melody. He adds a lot of notes.
But this melody is actually based on another that Schubert wrote, correct?
Right, that is correct. And it's based on a previous theme of Schubert from his Singspiel, Die Freunde von Salamanca.
Oh, yeah, so we'll have to take a listen to that one at some point as well. But we love this melody, so definitely a worthy one. And Schubert obviously liked it a lot since he used it again. So this next composer and piece that we're going to talk about is another one that we've just kind of recently stumbled upon purely by accident. I was doing some research for this. Fernando found the Schubert, and then I found this work, and we were both really taken aback by just the quality out of the gate. This is Mikhail Glinka's Trio Pathétique. Glinka was a Russian romantic composer, born in 1804, passed away in 1857. he's actually regarded as one of the earliest Russian romantic composers to have a unique voice, and he's known to some even as the father of Russian music.
Right, this is pre-Tchaikovsky, pre-Rimsky-Korsakov, all of those other Russian composers that you might be familiar with.
He had a huge influence on those composers as well. The Mighty Handful, Rimsky-Korsakov, Cui, Borodin, Mussorgsky, Balakirev, Tchaikovsky, outside of that, of course. Huge influence on all those composers, and you're going to hear a lot of what would become elements of the great Russian romantic composers in this piece, Trio Pathetique. And this is actually from the last movement of this work. I think you'll find this to be very Russian sounding in the best of ways. So enjoy Trio Pathetique by Glinka. That was Trio Pathetique by Mikhail Glinka. That was the last movement. What a great Russian-sounding work. We love this so much. This piece would become the inspiration, I think, for a lot of works, particularly Tchaikovsky's Fifth Symphony, maybe, and some of these really nationalist-sounding Russian works. It was actually written after an unsuccessful romance that Glinka was a part of, and he said in a letter, "The only way I know love is by the pain it causes." So the heartache that was felt by Glinka when he was writing this work definitely shows up here, particularly through the instrument choices. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Right, the instrumentation here is piano, clarinet, and bassoon. Unusual for a trio, especially at the time, I think. It really does give you that sense of sorrow or that feeling of sadness, I think, because it's a little bit more mellow instruments here, so
right,
it just has, I don't know, a tinge of sadness.
Right. Now, let's talk a little bit about the traditional piano trio, because we wanted to include a traditional piano trio work in this episode today, but then we came across this. What is the normal instrumentation for a piano trio?
So, a piano trio, you might be fooled by the name. It is not three pianos. It is actually a piano, a cello, and a violin.
And so, this is kind of similar in a way, just translated to wind instruments.
Yeah, it is very similar. You've got the piano and then your lower bass voice and then your upper treble voice here. So I think, yeah, it really translates well. And you said that it was actually written originally for the bassoon and clarinet, and now it has been adapted for the more traditional piano trio with violin and cello now.
This makes me want to write for this combination of instruments for the clarinet, bassoon, and the piano, because what a cool sound this is. And a lot of it is that quasi-orchestral Russian sound, but also I think that it holds its own as chamber music. I think that it's a very unique sound as chamber music, and definitely a great one, I think, to spread awareness of, because as far as I know, I've never heard anybody talk about this work.
Yeah, I haven't heard anybody talk about this one. I don't hear a lot of people talking about Glinka in general. So this is a great one. It's really unique, a really great contrast to the two previous ones. And it really is fascinating to me how he can get that symphonic sound with only three instruments.
Yeah, that small scale is crazy here. And I cannot be more excited to keep getting to know this work. But that was the last movement of Glinka's Trio Pathétique. What a great work. All right, so the next listen, we're kind of fast-forwarding a little bit through time. Now, a lot of you might know the German romantic composer Richard Strauss for maybe some of his more 20th century offerings, but this is a younger Richard Strauss. He was only 17 when he wrote this work, and this does not involve any strings or piano. This is his serenade for 13 wind instruments in E flat. Strauss is a really prolific German composer, conductor, seen often as the next in line after influential composers like Brahms or Wagner. He had an 8-decade long career. I always forget this, that Strauss lived from 1864 to 1949. His career was so immense. He wrote really delicate chamber works like this, but then he also wrote things like Elektra or the Alpine Symphony. Insane.
Right. Incredibly diverse. And it's because he's living through the most dynamic changes in music, in my opinion.
Oh, I agree.
Turn of the century period where everything is going in different directions. And I think Strauss really kept on his own path where he was doing romantic music for a while, and then he tried things, and some of it went great, and some of it wasn't as great. And so then he backtracked and said, you know what, I like romantic period sounding music. And so later in his career, he did a little bit of backtracking, but equally great music all the way across his whole career.
And I think you guys are going to really enjoy this work. This has been a favorite of mine for a long time. His Serenade for 13 Wind Instruments in E flat. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
What a gorgeous work. That's Richard Strauss Serenade for 13 wind instruments in E flat. This has been one of my favorites for a long time, and I just love the purity of the wind orchestration here. You have four horns, contrabassoon, bassoon, two bassoons, two clarinets, two oboes, and two flutes. I just went in reverse score order there. But I think that a lot of the depth here comes from the horns. And part of that is because his father, Franz Strauss, was a horn player of some repute. Admittedly, kind of it's inspiring a lot of his really virtuosic parts in his music, even at this young age. Keep in mind, he's 17 at the time he wrote this piece. So a lot of his music influence was from what he heard from his dad, professional horn player.
And I think that it's really cool to see kind of where Strauss started compositionally. And it takes a really close Strauss listener to be able to recognize this as Strauss if you just played it randomly, I think.
Well,
it has the characteristics of him, but you have to be well-versed in Strauss's music, I think.
The characteristics are purely in that, I think, come from the melodic strength that is displayed throughout Strauss music, particularly in pieces like the Alpine Symphony. I think I can draw a lot of parallels here melodically, and a lot of it goes back to the horn, I think. But then there's moments like the solo oboe or like solo clarinet. I'm like, that's very Straussian, but maybe a little bit less extreme than also Sprach or Till Eulenspiegel, you know, like.
Right. And I think it's also, I think it's the development too, that like the way that he develops the ideas is very much in his wheelhouse and how he does development. It is melody driven, like you said, and it takes a little bit, like it takes some time, and you have to sit there and listen to it, and it pays off in the end, right?
That was a 4-minute excerpt you just listened to. So like it takes its time to get to that arrival moment, but the payoff is so, so great here.
Mm-hmm.
The funny thing is with this, we're going back now to some of his other inspirations. At the time, his inspirations were works of Mozart and Beethoven, but also primarily of Haydn, the composer that we started today's episode with. So funny little link there. You'll see some more of that as we close things out. But I think that you can hear some of that melodic purity maybe that came from some of that classical style.
Yeah. And so with this being a work for winds, we've actually had a recent experience performing in this unusual time with smaller chamber groups of a wind ensemble.
Right.
And it's been a really fun time and a really unique experience to get to develop as musicians and make music together.
Right. Yeah, I've had the pleasure of being the graduate band assistant for the university that we both attend. And so I've been able to see both of the bands kind of tackle this a little bit differently. One group kind of went with more of a, they basically split the band into fourths, and they would have instrumentation and pieces that were written specifically for that. Band composers are actually now writing pieces that are specifically for what we call flex type ensembles or adaptable ensembles. So that was kind of an interesting experiment. And a lot of them, I would say, did a really great job of kind of sounding like full works, like some of these other more chamber works as well.
Yeah, and what I thought was interesting about the different approaches, it seemed like one band, one, you know, of the larger ensembles used the approach of splitting the band into kind of even parts,
into numbers, smaller bands,
right, into kinda smaller bands, and then chose the music, and the music didn't really matter to the ensemble or to like the size of the ensemble, the instrumentation of the ensemble, because it was, oh, this is a piece in four parts or five parts, and right, any ensemble could
play it. Trombone and bassoon and tenor sax all had one part, and that was part four that they play, and then part one would be trumpet one, flute. So if you had a flute and a alto sax, a bassoon, and a tuba, you can make a four-part piece work out of that.
Right. And meanwhile, the other ensemble, the other large ensemble, kind of went with a more music-specific approach where right. the performers were selected for specific pieces of music rather than being split evenly by the numbers, and then the performers right. were chosen for those pieces. So it's two different approaches that people might be interested in using with their own ensembles in the upcoming months.
Right, yeah, and I think that's really important for this time. For example, I performed one of Persichetti's first serenade for Ten Winds, which ended up being, the instrumentation is for a brass quintet and a woodwind quintet. So kind of traditional chamber music there. But then one of the ensembles that Fernando was in was actually an arrangement of that Frank Ticelli did of his own work, Vesuvius, that was written for full band, I believe back in 1999. And now he rearranged it for that Flex ensemble. So instead of playing the trumpet part like Fernando would in the band, he played a part that was kind of a mix of the alto sax part and the horn part and the trumpet part and all of these different things. I think you counted, you had like maybe like 10 measures of rest in that in that whole piece.
Right, yeah. Not too many rests there, but...
But you did a great job with it.
Well, and thank you.
I think that it challenges people in the same way that these chamber works that we've talked about today, where it requires you to be a really independent musician and be really forward-thinking. In this case, you were matching different timbres. You're like, well, in the original piece, the clarinet played this line, so I need to sound like a clarinet, but I'm playing this hunk of metal that's a trumpet. So
right, yeah.
It requires a lot of great musician brain to do that.
Right, yeah, some great musicianship and care. I was doing my best, so I'm and, glad it came out well.
Yeah, you did a great job. I think that this is... We thought that this was a timely topic to talk about these chamber works, and we also wanted to talk a little bit about our experience because there definitely was some trepidation going into this semester if we were going to even be able to make music together. But we're really glad that we got to come together in this intimate setting and still make music together.
Right, make music safely. And I think that we've talked about the accountability and the independent musicianship abilities that are enhanced here. I think that that's important during this time and in other times, at all times, really, whenever you're learning music. So if you're a band director or an orchestra director or somebody that teaches music, we encourage you to give chamber music a shot.
Yeah, it's very, very important. And we said that it's really been important for our development as musicians, and think that it can be important for anyone. Well, what do you say we jump into our last listening example here? This is actually a composer that we've talked about a few times now on the podcast. This is Antonín Dvořák, a Czech romantic composer who was born in 1841, passed away in 1904. So not alive for the same length of time as Dvořák. You'll notice that we've gone in chronological order up until this point. This is actually written after the Strauss Serenade in E-flat, the piece that we'll be talking about. So Dvořák spent most of his summers composing in the Czech Republic, but he also traveled pretty extensively in his years through Prague and New York and Vienna and Britain. In those famous travels to the United States, he actually becomes the director of the National Conservatory of Music in New York City for 3 years. During this time, he kind of discovers American music, folk, and orchestral, and he writes his most famous Ninth Symphony from the New World. That's where this piece, the piece that we'll be talking about today, comes into play. This is his string quartet number 12, subtitled American. And so he actually wrote this work in the summer of 1893 while he's on vacation in the state of Iowa, of all places in the United States. I never thought to associate Dvořák with the state of Iowa, but at the same time, it kind of makes sense in a way. I'm like, if any state be close to the Czech Republic, I'm like, maybe Iowa, I guess.
I guess so, yeah. And I think it really suits his music, too. I think the state of Iowa would be proud to know that
yeah.
He was composing there, or
what's the Music Man term? Iowa Stubborn. But so this is his string quartet number 12, subtitled American. Let's take a listen. That was Dvorak's string quartet number 12, subtitled American. What a great work. Obvious American inspiration here. I'm picturing the Wild West galloping in on horses here with this intro. That was the last movement of this string quartet, and definitely very appropriate for that, finishing this episode off some great chamber works. So this work was written during the summer of 1893, around the same time he's writing the New World Symphony, in the state of Iowa, believe it or not. He writes in this letter, "I have been on vacation since June 3rd here in the Czech village of Spillville, and I will not be returning to New York until the latter half of September. The children arrived safely from Europe, and we're all happy together. We like it very much here, and thank God I am working hard, and I'm healthy and in good spirits." So he mentions the Czech village of Spillville. That is a village in Iowa. The population at the time was primarily people in Czech. So he was surrounded by his people. He's happy and he's seeing all the beautiful nature. And that's part of what inspires him to write this work. He writes it in only 16 days. It's lightning in a bottle. He gets this idea and he just runs with it and is done with it.
Yeah, and that's great. I mean, that's so impressive that this came out of only 16 days of work. It very much is, or very much does sound like it has that natural sound, that inspired by nature, and also an American sound. And right. I think that that's really cool. And it definitely could have been used for the Lone Ranger instead of William Tell, right?
Right.
By the Italian composer Rossini. This one, at least Dvorak was in the United States here and composing it.
Right. Yeah, I think that that's a great comparison there. Like we said, it was written right after his famous New World Symphony, but it was actually before the New World Symphony had been premiered. So I guess he hadn't heard that work premiered yet. And I wanted to read another quote by Dvorak to kind of, that I felt like tied things together for this episode and also a little bit of his inspiration behind this piece. He said, "I wanted to write something for once that was very melodious and straightforward, and dear Papa Haydn kept appearing before my eyes, and that is why it all turned out so simply, and it's good that it did." So, you could see here that Dvorak is taking inspiration from the music of Haydn, and probably specifically the string quartets of Haydn. And we open today with the Lark Quartet by Haydn, and I think that there is definitely a great link between the music, because this is very straightforward and simple music. It's not, it doesn't feel like maybe a Webern string quartet or, you know, like it's not super dense. It's just, it's driving yet simple, almost in that American pastoral kind of sound that like Copland sometimes will use and composers like that. And I think part of that comes from also the American sounds, but also he takes a large inspiration from a lot of African-American spirituals of the time, which kind of creep into this work, which are characteristic of being plaintive harmonically, but really emotional in quality.
Right. Wow. Great description there. And it's all summed up by it being just kind of a more modern Haydn, I think.
Yeah.
It really does sound like that. I think there are a lot of similarities between the first listening of today and this one. So it's really cool to hear where music can go, especially chamber music, because it's an intimate setting and
right.
There's a lot you can do with a limited instrumentation.
Right. I think that the limitations inspire a lot of creativity in this. With a large-scale symphony, I think that people will get bogged down by maybe like, oh, like we have this big brass arrival here, or we have these crazy string tremolos or crazy woodwind runs, and then timpani and bass drum and snare drum. But then you strip all that away and you have a string quartet. The challenge is, what music can you make with this? And I think that both Haydn and Dvorak are just great examples of taking something smaller and really making art and making music out of it. And composers like Glinka and Schubert as well. I think that those both as well, kind of a more unique twist on it, especially the Glinka we talked about with the clarinet and the bassoon and the piano, the colors that it created. But regardless, chamber music is something that we're really passionate about, and we're glad that we got to share some of this with you today.
And if you're interested in looking for some chamber music, maybe you'll consider these, or maybe you'll look elsewhere. But either way, we're glad that we could share it with you. As always, if you were interested in the topic today, if you liked it, you can join in on the conversation in our social media avenues that are mentioned in the outro, as well as our email. Again, that one is also mentioned in the outro, so we'll get all that information in a second.
Right. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we'll see you again next Monday.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.